This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll see how a grassroots organization is quietly but steadily preserving one of our greatest liberties. That's the freedom to read in privacy at public libraries, a priority of the Library Freedom Project. The extradition hearing for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been put on hold until at least September. Nathan Fuller from the Courage Foundation will provide an update on Julian's health and what transpired in court just before the hearing was postponed. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Libraries in this country have long been sanctuaries in which to read, think, dream, and pursue intellectual endeavors free from judgment or outside intrusion. But historically, outside forces have tried to intrude on this sanctitude. During the Cold War, for example, librarians exposed the FBI's efforts to recruit library staff to spy on certain patrons, especially Russians, through the so-called Library Awareness Program. And after the attacks of September 11, 2001, the USA Patriot Act, Section 215, has often been dubbed the, quote, library provision. That's because it allows patrons' library records to be accessed and monitored by law enforcement agencies without a search warrant. In 2015, Law and Disorder reported on a New Hampshire library that installed Tor software that allows patrons to privately browse computers. Soon after that, the Department of Homeland Security contacted local state officials who visited the library, warning that Tor could aid criminal behavior. Our guest, Allison Macrina, was one of the people responsible for the New Hampshire Library's privacy tools. Allison is a librarian, privacy rights activist, and the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project, an initiative that helps educate librarians and local communities about surveillance threats, privacy rights and laws, and privacy-protecting technology tools to help safeguard digital freedoms. Allison Macrina, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison, congratulations are due. You're the 2020 recipient of the Library and Information Technology Association's Library High Tech Award.
Thank you. I'm very honored.
Well, it's a well-deserved award. Allison, let's start by talking about the Library Freedom Project. What is it?
Library Freedom Project is an organization that I started and run to bring a critical approach to technology into libraries. So I teach librarians about privacy and surveillance issues as a way of helping the broader public understand these issues and how they impact our lives.
And just to clarify, most libraries in the United States have computers available for patrons to use. Is that right?
That's right, and that's part of the reason that I started the project, because libraries are really the only place that most people can go and get assistance using their technology, whether it's using a library computer and the library's Wi-Fi, or whether it's using their own devices. And also, a lot of these people are the same people who are impacted by the loss of privacy and the expansion of police surveillance, government surveillance, and corporate surveillance.
And we'll talk about that topic in a few minutes. But what is the Institute part of the project?
So I had been running Library Freedom Project for a few years. I started, you know, the timeline is probably 2014 when I really officially got started, but I was funded and able to do it full time starting in 2015. And for the first few years, I was going around the United States and sometimes around the world, teaching librarians about these issues. And there was a great deal of interest, but I couldn't do it all by myself. And so I decided to start an intensive training program for other librarians that shared my values, that wanted to learn about these issues in a practical way. And so the Institute was born in 2017, and we run 4 to 6 month intensive training programs for library workers. And we cover a broad range of technology and surveillance issues. And then we work together as a community to come up with different kinds of strategies and mitigations, whether they're around public education, whether they're different changes to our library systems. But it's really, it's fundamentally a community of practice for librarians who want to fight surveillance.
Now, you recently authored a book called Anonymity. You co-authored it in the American Library Association Library Future series. Tell us, and I imagine this would be part of your institute training, about the importance of anonymity in libraries.
Well, the importance of anonymity in libraries, I think, is it's about the importance of anonymity more broadly speaking. Anonymity is increasingly unavailable to us given the way that the internet works. You know, when we go online, everything that we do is recorded, logged in some way, available to any number of actors. And this has pretty serious implications for the possibility of certain kinds of free expression. You know, anonymity can be used for all different kinds of purposes. But the thing is, we have these very powerful entities that run the internet, and those people who want to criticize them or organize against them, you know, I think, for example, of all the labor organizing that's happening in Amazon warehouses right now. Those people are going up against one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful corporation in the world. And so the ability to speak about it freely sometimes requires some degree of anonymity, whether it's just, you know, for a blog post or whether it's something that persists longer than that. And so I think of it as something very important to democracy. As for its role in libraries, it's the same role that any of these issues have. Libraries are in a really unique position to educate the public about our rights, about democracy, about how to express ourselves freely in a very unfree world. And so that's why we wrote the book. I wrote it with Talia Cooper, a colleague of mine who formerly was at First Look working on the Snowden docs, doing cool archival stuff over there.
Many people aren't aware that libraries in the past and present have actually been subject to government surveillance. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting history because on the one hand, we are kind of invisibilized. You know, we're a largely female profession. I think it's something like 90%. And so people don't pay attention to us. They don't pay us enough. They're constantly slashing our budgets. You know, 40 years of neoliberalism have not been kind to libraries. At the same time, there is a recognition by the powers that be of our power. It's a pretty big deal to have a place in your community where people can go and read and learn and research or just be with no expectation. There's no commercialization. There's no expectation of purchasing something. You can loiter there. I mean, this is extremely rare. And so given that power that we have, we have many adversaries. And so, you know, throughout the 20th century, there are all kinds of examples of, you know, for example, the FBI had a program for a long time where they thought that, you know, libraries were too radical, that we were all secret KGB agents, and they were surveilling us and our patrons and trying to set up some weird Cold War type case against us. You know, we've also come under fire for our opposition to the USA Patriot Act. That was part of the reason I became a librarian, and a lot of librarians I know, because we saw how our colleagues stood up to this very invasive new ordinance that most of our legislators passed without reading. So there is a really strong tradition of resistance and opposition, you know, particularly when it comes to threats to our civil liberties.
It's true that librarians have become, in many ways, unlikely heroes. I didn't know it, but I was on the website for the American Library Association and found a code of ethics. Talk about the role of librarians in terms of being gatekeepers of that code of ethics.
Well, I think it gets back to what I was saying about the power that we have in our communities. I think about libraries, in particular public libraries. I try to imagine someone creating the library today. I mean, this would never happen. It would be totally instrumentalized to get people to purchase things. It would be covered with ads if it existed at all. We see how important this thing is that we have, this space where it is not means tested. Anyone can go. Anyone can enjoy the materials there. We value a variety of opinions, particularly dissident opinions. And in order to protect that kind of a space, we need to have an ethical backbone. And so the code of ethics that you refer to, ALA, the American Library Association, created that, I think it was in 1939. And, you know, so the timeline is significant too, because then you're coming up against all kinds of anti-communist sentiment. You know, what people read is starting to be scrutinized heavily, all kinds of left views and trade union organizing are considered to be too radical. And so librarians in the midst of this decided that we had a mandate to protect certain democratic values. And so among our code of ethics is probably the most important one is intellectual freedom. We believe that anyone should be able to read, write, and research freely with no fear of repercussions. And then the kind of like attendant ethics that go with that, privacy, we see is important because if you don't have privacy, you can't have intellectual freedom. And then there are other, you know, similarly related ethics in there. So access, I forget exactly how it's named. You have to be able to get the materials that you want to read. Your intellectual freedom requires you to have the ability to view these materials and have regular access to them. And then there are some others like democracy, diversity, and other things that make our communities rich.
Allison, can you explain the difference between confidentiality and privacy in libraries?
I think one of them is a librarian-facing, a little bit more librarian-facing, and one of them is a little bit more patron-facing. So confidentiality in libraries to me means that if you visit my library, I have a responsibility to protect information that I learn about you in the course of you using the library. So your name and your address, the materials you check out. If I'm learning any other sensitive information, like something about your immigration status or anything like that, it's my duty as a librarian to keep that confidential and to make sure that I've set up my system in such a way that an adversary, like law enforcement or a government actor or something, can't easily obtain that information from me. And then privacy, I think, is a little bit more expansive and, like I said, a little bit more patron-facing because we want our patrons to come into our buildings and feel like they have privacy to act as they wish because, you know, we don't want them to self-censor thinking that people are watching them or that they don't have that kind of freedom.
It's hard to believe, but the last time we spoke with you was in 2015. That was just after the Kilton Library in West Lebanon, New Hampshire, installed the anonymous browsing software and Relay Tor. And local police were tipped off by Boston Department of Homeland Security and paid a visit. Can you do a quick recap about that for listeners?
Yeah, so we had been working with the Tor Project. We just started working with the Tor Project at the time. Tor Project makes anonymity software. It's the main piece of software is something called Tor Browser. When you use it, you can view websites without anyone knowing who you are and where you're coming from, and without those websites knowing that you're visiting other websites. And we had started working with libraries to help them understand Tor and what it could mean for their patrons. And we had some very enthusiastic librarians who were interested in going all the way in their support of Tor, so not just installing Tor Browser, but running the Tor relays, which are kind of the backbone of the network. They make the whole thing go. And so we made this happen at this wonderful Hilton Library, part of the Lebanon Libraries in New Hampshire. We got a little bit of positive press, and that tipped off the Department of Homeland Security field office, and then they had the local police intervene on their behalf, and they basically said, you shouldn't be running this thing. It's only used for nefarious purposes, and you have to shut it down. Well, what they didn't bargain for is that the community in New Hampshire not only was very supportive of the library, was also very supportive of Tor, and we had people not just locally but all over the country who heard about this happening and saw, rightly, a big, scary government, you know, federal law enforcement agency going after a tiny little community library. And so, you know, everybody loves a David and Goliath story. So people really rallied around this library and showed their support, and the library board convened a meeting and heard from many community members who spoke out in favor of using Tor and supporting the Tor network. And so the library ended up turning the relay back on. We never heard from DHS ever again. And it was just a really beautiful story of community resilience. And I think, you know, for me, one of the most special things about it was that it really exploded the myth that people don't care about their privacy or they don't see the value in taking big steps to protect their privacy, because they really did see it. And they particularly saw it, you know, seeing how this law enforcement agency wanted to take away their ability to do that.
Have other libraries across the nation installed the Tor browser since then?
Yeah, you know, it's something like a dozen libraries are either running the Tor relay or have installed Tor browser. In some ways, you know, the whole thing was a really wonderful, as soon as I got the email that said DHS is going after this library, I knew the library was scared, but I was like, this is the best thing that's ever happened, because I knew they were going to lose. But in some ways, it was a bad thing for us to get so much early attention for, because Tor browser is like, it's sort of the intermediate to advanced step for libraries to take with regard to making privacy changes. And so it's not really for everyone. A lot of libraries have some really 101 level stuff to do first. And so we love libraries installing Tor browser. You know, probably the biggest one that's done it is the Toronto Public Library. They have a program where they have started installing it on all the computers across their entire enormous system. But for most libraries, I think that a much more realistic first or second step would be teaching a class about good passwords and avoiding identity theft and doxing and data brokers and sort of understanding the landscape a little bit more at a much more simple level.
Allison, what is a privacy audit, and do libraries have these?
A privacy audit is basically taking an inventory of your systems, particularly those systems that have some access to people's personally identifiable information, other sensitive data, taking an inventory of all these systems and then looking at where they are collecting information, storing information, who has access to that information, what your policies are about law enforcement requests, you know, looking at the entire landscape of your data and then thinking about how private the system is and then what changes you can make to it. And there are a number of libraries that have started conducting privacy audits. I have a colleague named Erin Berman, who's in California, who has been really spearheading this. You know, one of the great things about having a code of ethics in our profession that includes privacy and that people take very seriously is that there's a lot of really cool people working on these issues and kind of covering different aspects. And so Erin's work has helped a lot of libraries do perform these audits and do them regularly and make sure that we aren't leaking sensitive information in some way that we're not aware of.
We have a few minutes remaining, Allison. You've said that the risk of criminal activity taking place on Tor is not a sufficient reason to suspend its use. For comparison, you've said the city is not going to shut down its roads simply because some people choose to drive drunk. I love that analogy. Can you briefly talk about what I think is a myth that Tor is solely the domain for, as you've said, nefarious activities?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the important things that I try to clarify is that people who want to do really bad things on the internet will find a way, because if they're willing to break the law to do it, then there are options available to them. The thing that Tor offers is a way for anybody, regardless of their reason, to use the internet anonymously. And people who need that capability but aren't doing criminal activities, aren't willing to break the law, if Tor were to go away, they would have no option. The other thing I think is that in many places, fundamental free expression is illegal. In countries like ours, where it's technically not illegal, there are very serious consequences for it. Maybe not criminal consequences, actually probably in some cases criminal consequences, but for the most part, you know, you could lose your job for expressing an opinion about, you know, a pro-union opinion, or, you know, you could be kicked out of your home if you were, you know, if you're an LGBT teenager. So I think that, you know, to me, Tor is important. Even if there are people who use it to do bad things, I don't want those people to do it, but I know that if it disappeared tomorrow, many other people who need it for life and death matters would suffer.
Allison, if we may ask a personal question, which came first, the librarian or the privacy advocate in you?
That's a good question. You know, I think probably the librarian, but like I said, I became a librarian in part because I was in college when the Patriot Act, I had just started college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I just knew that I wanted to do something that was, you know, had some meaning and purpose, and at best, I didn't want to do any harm. And I saw these librarians standing up to this massive government overreach at a time that I know you remember, there was not very much public dissent, and it was widely criticized if you took any kind of public stand. And so for this profession to decide that it was worth it for them to be in the crossfire, you know, the John Ashcroft went after librarians for their opposition to the Patriot Act. And I thought that was really brave. And there weren't a lot of examples of bravery then, especially at that scale. And so even though that had to do with privacy, I think that for me, it was really more about the collective resistance and the willingness to be brave in public.
A final question. What do you see as the greatest threats to libraries right now?
Well, I think that given everything that is happening with the coronavirus crisis, I think that libraries' budgets are going to be seriously threatened. We saw major cuts to our funding during the economic recession in 2008 and the ensuing years. And so I think that that is going to be an enormous threat. I think that making the case for our importance in an environment where public funding is going to be slashed. I mean, we see already all these forces using this crisis as an opportunity to defund the public sector, to deregulate. And so libraries are going to be victim to that at the same time that we will be more needed than ever, because more people will require our services, more people will not be able to afford internet access or home technology, more people will need job placement assistance and all the other services that we offer. And so, I think that our fundamental existence is threatened right now. And so I would ask your listeners to use the library's resources right now, click on their links, watch their Facebook videos, you know, show. They're going to need that data later to show usage metrics to be able to fight for our funding.
Oh, that's a really important call to action, Allison. And we'll put something up on our website urging listeners to do that. Before we let you go, how can our listeners learn more about your work and other ways they can get involved?
So everything about Library Freedom Project is at libraryfreedom.org. You can get in touch with us. You can learn more about our Institute graduates and the work that they're doing out in communities and ways that you can get involved with us.
Well, Alice and Makrina, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're just an amazing leader in the field of privacy for librarians and their patrons. So we wish you the best of luck, and we'd like to stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Heidi. It's really great to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition hearing began in January in London, but is on hiatus at least until September 2020. At the January appearance, the prosecution pleaded for the media to stop characterizing the U.S. effort as a politicized war on journalism. In response, Julian's defense provided a comprehensive summary of the many reasons journalists and human rights activists have called Julian's indictment a threat to the free press. James Lewis argued for the Crown Prosecution Service, which acts on behalf of the United States in its extradition request. Lewis explicitly asked journalists covering the case not to report that it represents a matter of free speech or the right to publish. He depicted the indictment as solely a matter of exposing informants in the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs and the State Department cables. Julian's defense attorney, Edward Fitzgerald, detailed how extradition proceedings constitute an abusive process. He asserted that they've been brought for ulterior political purposes, as an attack on freedom of speech, and fundamentally misrepresent the facts in order to extradite Julian to the U.S., where he certainly faces torture as well as unusual and degrading treatment. Joining us for an update on this story, which we're continuing to cover, is Nathan Fuller, Executive Director of the Courage Foundation. Nathan, Welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, Nathan, with health on everyone's mind, let's check in about Julian's health. How is he doing, both mentally and physically?
So, unfortunately, we do not have enough access to Julian by way of his lawyers because Julian Assange has had extremely limited access with his legal team, which was already an issue before this coronavirus pandemic. He had already talked to the court about inadequate participation in his own legal defense, and since the lockdown, that has only gotten worse. He was effectively in solitary confinement and speaks to his legal team very infrequently, so updates are harder to come by than they even were before. But we do know that he was unable to even participate in a video link legal proceeding in which his originally scheduled for May 18th extradition hearing was postponed. So there are ongoing concerns about his health, and that's why we're calling for him to be released, at least on bail right now, just to protect him from the virus.
Was Julian in the courtroom when the extradition hearings began back in January, but then were discontinued?
Yeah, so the first week in London of the proper extradition hearing was actually in February, and Assange was in the back of the courtroom in the glass dock, and that actually became a topic of discussion because from that glass dock, it was very difficult for him to participate in the hearing, to hear anything, or to communicate with his legal team. But he was in court. He looked thin and was obviously struggling to concentrate, but one day I was up in the public press gallery. He did give a fist up to the supporters and his family there.
Oh, dear. Let's talk briefly about what happened at that point. I understand that the government made claims of damage to U.S. interests globally, claiming that the unredacted WikiLeaks State Department cables, and to remind listeners, these were released 10 years ago, but they allege that it put local informants at risk. What evidence did the government's attorney offer to support those claims?
Yeah, so as you say, the government has had 10 years now, and they have been unable to provide anything concrete. You know, I covered Chelsea Manning's court-martial hearing back in 2012 and 13, and I heard the court have to say in open court, I heard the U.S. have to say in open court that actually they could not provide any evidence of a death caused by WikiLeaks releases. This is despite all the headlines and, you know, attention-getting headlines saying WikiLeaks and Assange and Manning have blood on their hands, and reporters are willing to report that without the evidence. But then when it comes to the time in court when they have to, on sworn testimony, talk about actual damage, they have not been able to provide any deaths. So that is the same 10 years later.
I understand that the judge asked if the actual act of obtaining the documents constitutes one of the conducts charged. Does it follow that any person who just obtained those kinds of documents without the aiding and abetting elements, would that person be subject to prosecution as well? So that, for example, if a newspaper just obtains documents without working with the source to get them, could that publication be unlawful? And the lawyer said yes.
Yes, and that's even before a publication, which is its own extremely concerning First Amendment issue. But yes, simply obtaining or receiving. And then, of course, there are other issues of soliciting or conspire to publish. But yeah, just obtaining these documents, you know, possessing them. And this is the problem with the incredibly broad Espionage Act of 1917 and the way that the government uses it. It is trying to criminalize the unauthorized possession of classified documents, even when it's for First Amendment journalistic purposes. And this is really dangerous for the future of journalism in America.
It is, and if we look back in history, that would mean, I assume, that papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, when they got the COINTELPRO papers in the early 70s anonymously I guess they could be charged on that count.
Exactly, and the Pentagon Papers, just the receipt of. So this is the Trump administration's escalation of or attempt to do what previous governments and administrations have not been able to do, to finally close the book on this kind of serious investigative journalism that we really rely on, that without which we wouldn't know about tens of thousands of uncounted in Iraq and Afghanistan, evidence of torture, corporate corruption. We would not know about this if these journalistic outlets were not allowed to have these documents.
Now, the day after Attorney Lewis made claims of the harm caused by the cables, the defense explained something that happened with two Guardian journalists. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes. So in late 2010, I believe it was November, the WikiLeaks and its media partners began to publish the State Department cables known as Cablegate. And that continued for several months, but it was not the full tranche of documents. It was a very carefully redacted set of documents that WikiLeaks worked with its media partners to very carefully redact, even redacting more than some media organizations would have liked. But one of those media organizations, of course, was The Guardian. And in early 2011, just a few months after the State Department cables began to be published, David Lee of The Guardian published a book about working with WikiLeaks and the cables, in which he published a password as the name of a chapter, not hiding it at all, published a password that months later eventually helped people who could dig hard enough to find the full unredacted tranche of State Department cables. This was leaked to WikiLeaks. This information was made aware to WikiLeaks. Julian Assange and Sarah Harrison called the U.S. government to notify them, but their concerns were unanswered. And the WikiLeaks was then forced to, because it was already out there, forced to publish the full unredacted cables. And so this is what's at issue. This September 2011 publication of unredacted cables is what the government is trying to punish WikiLeaks for, without acknowledging that WikiLeaks was not responsible for putting this information out there in the first place.
Hmm. On a related note, and I think that the government's, and maybe I'm wrong, the government's lack of understanding about certain technology facets, whether it's real or fabricated, might factor into some of these computer-related charges. The 18th count against Julian that bolsters the government's theory that he aided and abetted Chelsea Manning's 2010 disclosures is conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. But what's wrong with the charge that Julian essentially agreed to help Chelsea try to crack a military computer password so she could log in anonymously, allowing her to continue to obtain and disseminate classified information without exposing her identity?
Right. As you say, it's good of you to point out that we're not really sure if they actually don't know about this or are kind of pretending to, because it certainly works in their favor to oversimplify and reduce the case to its own narrative. And so it selects and plays selective with the facts in order to do so. And yeah, the problem with this charge, or one of the many problems, actually, because another one of the problems is that it just attempts to criminalize journalistic and source communications, but it is the fact that Chelsea Manning had already leaked a significant number of documents to WikiLeaks before this alleged password conversation. And so she was not trying to get access to anything she didn't have access to already, and she had already passed documents. And so the government is trying to portray Julian as someone who's goading Chelsea to leak more, trying to, you know, use her as his puppet, basically, to steal documents for WikiLeaks. But that just misunderstands Chelsea's whistleblowing motives, for one thing, but also misunderstands the facts, which is that she had already been releasing documents to WikiLeaks well before this.
Good point. Now, let's turn to the defense briefly. The defense attorney claimed that the extradition proceedings constitute an abuse of process. How so?
Right. So that's actually a multi-pronged argument, and there are more aspects of it are going to come out later on. But one of them is just the fact on its face that Assange is supposed to be extradited under the U.S.-UK extradition treaty, but that treaty explicitly bars extradition for political offenses. And this is obviously and transparently a political case. It's use of espionage, which is an obvious and hallmark political crime, but it's also one that the Obama administration chose not to make. And there's no new evidence or anything in the last several years. It's just that the Trump administration has decided it wants to go one step further. And so this is just an escalation without new evidence and just a clearly abusive process.
You know, this specific point reminds us about the Lynn Stewart case years ago when Janet Reno, under the Clinton administration, just gave Lynn sort of a slap on the wrist for violating prison special administrative measure, which wasn't a criminal offense. But then when John Ashcroft came in under George W. Bush, they indicted Lynn, and she was ultimately sentenced to a decade in prison before released on compassionate grounds. But if these two examples don't constitute political indictments, I don't know what does.
Exactly right. And the judge listened to some of those arguments, but the U.S. government attempted to claim that WikiLeaks or Assange was not a political actor. And so it's trying to kind of have it both ways, because back in 2010, political officials were constantly saying Assange has political motives, he's trying to change U.S. policy. But now that it is a real factor in the extradition case, it's trying to say this is not a political case. This is just an ordinary, thief who's trying to, and then a spy, essentially, by charging him under for stealing and then under the Espionage Act, and trying to erase his political motives as well, clearly trying to expose U.S. policy, which is affecting the entire world.
Speaking of politics, I understand that U.S. Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher visited Julian in 2017, making clear that he, the congressman, was representing Donald Trump. And I read that Rohrabacher offered Julian a preemptive pardon or a helpful deal in exchange for Julian identifying the source of the 2016 DNC leaks. That sounds political to me.
Certainly does sound political. And I've seen those reports as well, but that has not come out in court just as such yet. So I'm curious to see if we're going to hear more about that in the remaining 3 weeks.
Has there been a development since those initial days back in February, the beginning of the extradition hearing, which has now been postponed?
So there have been a bail application, of course, for Julian under the coronavirus crisis. He is at great risk, and physically and mentally his health is deteriorating, and he has a chronic lung condition, and he's in a prison where he's really not able to protect himself, and where other inmates have already died from COVID-19. And so he has applied for bail, saying he was willing to report all the time and have an ankle monitor and everything just to be able to participate in his legal defense and protect himself from coronavirus. But that decision was rejected. Bail was denied. Now we are waiting for, we have a new extradition date, but just waiting for the crisis to pass or to protect him and try to get him more access to his legal team.
And the new date, is that in September?
So that was set last week, and you can find more about it at defend.wikileaks.org.
Okay. You alluded to Trump's views toward leakers, whistleblowers. Would you say that he's waging a war against leakers and journalists in general?
and against journalism in general, and this is a continuation and escalation of what we saw with the Obama administration, which prosecuted more whistleblowers than all previous presidents combined. The Trump administration is continuing that, aggressively persecuting whistleblowers, but now it's taking this one step further, going to the publisher as well. And this is a decision the Obama administration explicitly and told the Washington Post that it was deciding not to make because of what they called the New York Times problem. If we punish WikiLeaks for this, how can we not punish the New York Times for the exact same activity?
When we spoke to you last a couple of months ago, we briefly discussed the fact that it was taking a while for more mainstream journalists to catch on to the importance of this case for a free press. Is Julian garnering more and more support?
So while he's not, filling op-ed pages with, supportive opinion pieces, I am heartened to see the top newsroom editors from the Washington Post, the New York Times, to the Guardian have at least come out and said that this indictment is seriously dangerous. We recently held a webinar, an online video panel, on World Press Freedom Day, May 3rd, in which Ewan McCaskill, formerly of The Guardian, and Barton Gellman, formerly of The Washington Post, now a writer for The Atlantic, both of whom won Pulitzers for their Snowden reporting, both condemned these charges and talked about the indictment as a serious threat to press freedom. And so I think people are really starting to realize just how dangerous this is and the fact that they could be next.
Nathan, can you please remind our listeners about the kinds of surveillance that Julian experienced while holed up at the Ecuadorian embassy?
Yes, and there's an ongoing legal case about this in Spain right now. So the Ecuadorian government hired this security company called UC Global to surveil the embassy. And we have recently learned from essentially whistleblowers from within UC Global that it's the founder of UC Global, David Morales, entered into a contract with the U.S. government, we think the CIA, to essentially spy on Assange 24/7, providing videos and audio recordings and spying on any visitor who came into, they took the phones of any visitor who came into the embassy to visit him. And trying to get information and sending this back in real time to the CIA. So the U.S. government has already seen his legally privileged discussions with his legal team, with his private visitors, his family. It's an incredibly intrusive spying operation that Spain is now hearing. The Spanish court is hearing evidence against David Morales for this espionage operation.
And is information about that proceeding on the WikiLeaks website?
Yes, and you can find more about that. El País has done an incredible job of reporting on this, and we've recapped some of those reports at defend.wikileaks.org. But I highly recommend checking out El País's coverage.
Oh, great. Now, we have a few minutes remaining, Nathan. How does Julian's case align with the mission of the Courage Foundation?
Well, he's an exemplary beneficiary. We want to support journalistic sources and the public's right to know. And so this is kind of a combination of both. We want to protect Julian Assange personally, but also defend his right to have journalistic source communications, his right to publish, and our right to know what our government is doing. And so we support Assange. We raise money for his legal defense. We're holding webinars, publicly campaigning for him. And so you can find, defend.wikileaks.org is right now where we're writing about Assange's case and hosting public events.
And who else does the Courage Foundation support aside from Chelsea Manning and I think Jeremy Hammond?
Hammond, yeah. And initially we were raising funds for Edward Snowden and helping make his legal document or his NSA revelations more easily accessible in a searchable text format. We're also the defense campaign for Lori Love, a UK citizen who was facing extradition himself to the United States, and which we successfully beat back that extradition request after a high court said that U.S. prison conditions were too dangerous and had too inadequate of mental health care saying that to send Laurie to the U.S. would essentially mean sending him to his death.
That was an amazing victory. Congratulations on that.
Thank you, and hope we can replicate it for Julian.
Yes. Now, how can listeners learn more about your work, and if they want help support you or get involved?
Yeah, get in touch with us, courage.contact@couragefound.org, but also check out defend.wikileaks.org, and we're soon going to be announcing the website of a new U.S. organization, trying to bring together organizers from across the United States to hold public rallies and in defense of Julian Assange. So look out for that, and find us on Twitter at couragefound.
Well, Nathan Fuller, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with everything. And we look forward to continuing this conversation and hoping Julian all the best.
Thank you, and I appreciate you giving this case the time it deserves. Thank you.
Years, days, makes no difference to me, babe. You look exactly the same to me.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web.
Legs inside the diner, raising the coffee to your lips, the steam. You saw the masterpiece, she looks a lot like you.
sky is blue. Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east.
Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be lost. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are dying. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?